been with us, what we're doing is we're studying the Gospel of Mark, and we're looking at Mark through the eyes of a question that is inspired from a passage in John's Gospel, where Jesus, in his prayer, says, "I do not ask thee," speaking to his Father, "to take them," that is my disciples, "out of the world, but to keep them from the evil one." And this whole matter of the challenge of being in the world but not of the world. How are we to be in the world and not be defiled by the world? That's one of the questions that logically is raised when we contemplate that big question of what it means to be in the world and not of the world. And what we're doing is we're going through the Gospel of Mark and we're looking at Jesus' life asking that question. What does he teach us? And what does he model for us about what that means? And this morning I want to just pose some questions for us. What should we do in situations like this? And again, these are things related to this whole challenge of being in but not of the world. For example, educational affiliation. Should my children go to public school, to private school, to Christian school, or be homeschooled? And many people believe that the public school situation is, for the purposes of defilement, very defiling. So if you want to educate your children in a Christian context, you have to keep them out of public school. Homeschooling is preferable. Christian school, also an option, so forth and so on. Some people feel very strongly about this. But that's a real question. In terms of being in but not of the world, what do we do about educational choices? And specifically about the homeschooling and private Christian schooling. TV or not TV? I mean, that's a big one for some people. We have several friends who do not have television in their house. And again, the rationale is that this can be defiling in some way. It basically teaches us to be couch potatoes. It indoctrinates us with the philosophy of a secular society, so forth and so on. This is an illustration I've used over and over again, and it's one that I'm committed to in terms of my relationship to my own children, and now their children in the same way. I say there are three types of parents. There are bodyguards, lifeguards, and swimming instructors. The bodyguards keep the children away from the water, that is the world. The lifeguards rescue children as soon as they get in the world. Pull them out. And the lifeguards basically, at a very early age, help children learn how to swim. Now, this is risky because when children learn how to swim, they're not going to be real confident. They're not going to be real safe. Parents take risks. Kids take risks. But in the long run, I would argue, that is the way in which you survive in the world and not of the world. You can't keep the defiling influences of our environment away forever. And very frankly, there are certainly wonderful exceptions to this, but I have painful memories and observations of children who were wonderfully protected through most of their life. And then when they finally could be protected no longer, did not know how to swim. And I can remember my first year as a young fraternity man in college, seeing a lot of guys in my fraternity who had been in that kind of environment. And the first semester in a liberal university wiped them out. They had no way of coping with the kinds of changes that they were forced to make in that environment. More we can say, social and political affiliation. I mean, how many people have been defiled by being Republicans or Democrats? And I know that's not funny for a lot of people in this room. But the idea of someone's political affiliation is defiling in the minds of many of us. Or if not a political affiliation, certainly a political position on an issue. Denominational affiliation, this is a big one right now. If you're in the PCUSA, Presbyterian Church, or if you're in the Anglican Church, or in the Methodist Church, or the Lutheran Church, and the Southern Baptist Church, there's a lot of tension in terms of are we defiled, is our family defiled, if we continue with a denomination that has at fundamental levels departed from what we consider to be the Orthodox faith. What do you do, being in the world but not of the world? Do you stay in the denomination or do you leave? We have congregations, you know, near us that are struggling with that, and Christians who are struggling with that. Material lifestyle. Do we become defiled when basically we have a home at the beach? Or when we have two cars? Or when we have any number of other things that constitute the stuff of this world? Does that have a defiling effect on us? These are questions that we raise. Or alcohol or teetotalers. That's less an issue now than it was a few years ago, and it's less of an issue in an independent church than in a Baptist church. But I know in the Baptist church that I attended when I was a university student, I mean, that was a no-brainer. I mean, if you were a Christian, you did not drink. I remember how I wasn't shocked because I knew this, but I was taken back with when I was a young Christian and went to a conference in California where there were students from Europe who were attending as well. And when they saw some of the taboos that existed in American Christianity, I mean, they scratched their head and they couldn't understand why in the world drinking was such a big problem here. Not only a problem in terms of abstaining completely, but also in terms of the culture generally. In Europe, many of you are citizens outside the United States and know this very well. In Europe, this is just not an issue. And in much of the world, it's not an issue. The interesting thing was, these same people have had real disgust with the way in which American young people would pair off and date because this Swedish friend that I had said that in Sweden, you know, that was immoral. You did not have one-on-one dating. It was group dating until you got engaged. So they were basically had different taboos, but the taboos were related to the culture in some way. Contact with anything demonic. This is a no-no. Do you have any books in your home that deal with Satanism or the demonic? Having them in your home, having the book in your home, can be defiling. Have you ever been to a seance of any kind? Have you ever had any contact with any kind of paraphernalia or something like this having to do with the demonic? We are told, can be defiling. It's not that you have to buy into it, it's just the contact with it can be defiling. It's interesting. I had a conversation with a person that I love and respect a great deal several years ago about child rearing, where we happened to have some disagreements. And they were noting that our children were being allowed to, they were in high school, being allowed to read Stephen King novels. Well, they felt that was irresponsible on our part as parents, because this could be defiling to them. Well, and I explain, I understand your concern, and I have some concerns myself. But I pointed out this passage in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Unfortunately, it didn't make any difference in terms of my argument. I thought it was a slam dunk, but it didn't work. In 1 Corinthians chapter 10, Paul raises a question that I think is very, very interesting. He says in verse 20, "But I say that things which the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons and not to God." In other words, meat sacrificed at a heathen altar, Paul recognized as being a sacrifice to a demon. It's part of demon worship. And then he goes to the same passage on in verse 23 and says, if you go to a Gentile's home or a pagan's home and they serve you meat, eat it. There's nothing wrong with the meat. If they tell you the meat has been sacrificed to a demon, then don't eat. But here's the reason you don't eat. It's not that you might be defiled. It's that you might be misunderstood. In other words, you might lead them astray, suggesting that you too worship demons. Now, the significant part here is this. Paul was not concerned about any defilement coming from meat offered in a worship service to demons. Listen, if anything by contact should defile a person, that would do it. But Paul was not concerned about that. No danger there. The danger was in the example you set. The fact that it might be misunderstood. And I think this tells us a great deal about the kind of security and the lack of fear with respect to contact that Paul had with respect to the Christian church. And I think it gives us a certain amount of comfort. In other words, the implication is, don't be too concerned or anxious about being in the wrong place, the wrong time, and touching the wrong thing. That's not going to defy you. Nonetheless, defilement is real. And we're going to look at a passage in Mark chapter 7 where this comes about. Mark 7, verse 5 and following. And the Pharisees and the scribes asked him, why do your disciples not walk according to the tradition of the elders, but eat their bread with impure hands? And he said to them, rightly did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites, as it is written, this people honor me with their lips, but their heart is far from me, and in vain do they worship me, teaching as doctrines the precepts of men, neglecting the commandments of God, you hold to the tradition of men. Now we'll skip ahead to verse 14. And after he called the multitude to him again, he began saying to them, listen to me, all of you, and understand. There is nothing outside the man which going into him can defile him. But the things which proceed out of the man are what defile the man. If any man has ears to hear, let him hear. And when leaving the multitude, he had entered the house, his disciples questioned him about the parable. And he said to them, are you so lacking in understanding also? Do you not understand that whatever goes into a man from outside cannot defile him? Because it does not go into his heart, but into his stomach, and is eliminated. Thus he declared all foods clean. And he was saying, that which proceeds out of a man, that is what defiles a man. From within, out of the heart of man, proceed the evil thoughts, fornications, thefts, murders, adulteries, deeds of coveting and wickedness, as well as deceit, sensuality, envy, slander, pride, foolishness. All these evil things proceed from within and defile the man. Now, putting this in the context of the Jewish culture in which Jesus is speaking, in which Jesus lived, there are certain things that are helpful for us to understand. Jewish holiness was not so much a heart issue. At the heart of Jewish holiness is separation from defilement through improper physical contact with the Gentile world and with anything else designated as unclean. But I think the important thing to understand Jesus' teaching and Jesus' experience in the story is the fact that he was speaking to a Jewish audience, a very religious, very zealous, very deeply committed Jewish audience, the Pharisees, who saw defilement as basically avoiding contact, avoiding physical contact with anything that was going to pollute them or render them unclean. And generally, defilement in Jewish tradition fell into two categories. Ceremonial laws that priests, before he could go into the temple, had to ceremonially wash himself to erase any defilement of contact with the Gentile world or with anything else unclean. And when he was ceremonially clean, he could go into the temple and with confidence and perform his services. Or moral law. In the case of obeying or disobeying one of the moral commandments, that would be defiling. And it required sacrifice to make atonement for the sin of defiling. In this case, the Jews were basically, in the context of the story, were looking at ceremonial regulations, proscriptions, and being very careful that you washed your hands at certain times, you ate and didn't eat certain things, so forth and so on. Jesus' disciples were ignoring this. They were saying, the Pharisees were saying, if you're a holy man, if you're really a real prophet, how can this be? And Jesus is making the correction that defilement has virtually nothing to do with what you touch or where you are or what you eat, even. It has to do with your heart and what's coming out of you. Now, there are a number of general observations we can make before we look at this more specifically. One is this. Defilement is a real possibility. And the way I define defilement is this. Defilement is basically anything that destroys your Christian testimony. Anything that basically takes your testimony of being an image-bearing disciple of Jesus Christ and pollutes that, destroys that, erodes that. That is what defilement consists of. Defilement can come in spite of religious zeal or good intentions. No one ever criticized the Pharisees for not being zealous for the real God. They had, as Paul said, a zeal for God, but not according to knowledge. They didn't understand the gospel, but they had zeal. And they had passion. They had good intentions. As a matter of fact, their intentions in terms of adding to the law to be sure no one got close to breaking the law were really well-intended and noble in many respects. They wanted to protect the people of Israel from God's judgment to the point where if you were not to work on the Sabbath, they would specify exactly what kind of things you should do to not even getting close to working on the Sabbath. I mean, laws that seem to us to be ridiculous. For example, if a person would spit on the Sabbath into dry, dusty ground and move the earth, that might constitute plowing. I'm not making this up. You are not to spit on dust on the Sabbath because it might be construed as plowing and you're getting close to breaking the law of working on the Sabbath. Now then you can't say these people weren't zealous and didn't have intentions in terms of really wanting to please God. But as Jesus points out, they were missing it completely. Thirdly, defilement is the fruit of a heart that is detached from God's heart. What was lacking in Israel, and specifically in its leaders, was not adherence to a microscopic view of the commandments of God. It was the fact that in all of their hard work and zeal and passion, somehow they missed the heart of God. And in missing the heart of God, they missed basically everything. At that point, they became defiled. They could not be trusted in terms of their judgments. Common misplaced fears that we have in our Christian life that I think are addressed by this story in Mark's Gospel. Contact with the material world is defiling. That's a very, very common mistake we make. Boy, if your kids go to public school, or if you have a book on demonism in your home, or if you are a Democrat, or Republican, depending on which side of the aisle you're on, you know, all these things, or if you basically are wealthy and have two cars and two homes, so forth and so on, these things are, you have TV, you know, that you're just asking for trouble. That's going to be defiling. This is a great, I believe, misplaced expectation and needs to be corrected by this passage. 2 it's what you do that makes you worldly. When you talk about being not of the world, we're talking here about not doing the things that violate the commandments of God that are often common and accepted in the world. What Jesus challenges us to see is that worldliness really is not so much or primarily or only what we do. It's where the doing comes from, what motivates us. And it's possible to do the right things and still be very worldly. It's possible to have a squeaky, clean, outward appearance. That's the way Jesus described the Pharisees. They're whitewashed. On the outside, they look good, but inside, dead men's bones. Inside, they are defiled. They don't share the heart of God. Pollution of our testimony from the inside out is the way I describe defilement. I think two passages were in the New Testament in the writings of Paul and of the author of Hebrews. We get hints of the way in which defilement was viewed by the apostles. To the pure, all things are pure, Paul says. But to those who are defiled and unbelieving, nothing is pure. For both their mind and their conscience are defiled. And what he's saying here is this: the things you touch, food, ceremonies, places, things, etc., etc., that's not the problem. And if you have a good heart, you're free to do those things, touch those things. But if your heart's not right, no matter what you touch, you're defiled or you're troubled. I mean, you may do the right thing, you may convince people around you that basically you have life all together, but if your heart is not sharing the heart of God, if it's full of pride, if it's narcissistic, it's all about me, if it's all about finding your way in this world and Jesus being an aid to that, which is so much a part of our culture, or even our Christian culture, then Jesus would suggest you're defiled already, no matter how good you look. In the Hebrews chapter 12, verse 15, see to it that no one comes short of the grace of God, that no root of bitterness spring up, causing trouble, and by it many be defiled. And here again, the writer of Hebrews is saying, what defiles a person is the root of bitterness, the inability to forgive, the unwillingness to forgive, something on the inside. Again, it's not the contact, but it's the content of our heart. Romans chapter 12, verses 1 and 2, a passage that if you haven't memorized, don't worry about it, because you will memorize it in this class. You'll see it so often. It comes up over and over again. This is, I think, a pivotal verse in the book of Romans, and powerful. I urge you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is the will of God, that which is good, acceptable, and perfect. Being in and not of the world involves three things in this verse. Sacrifice. This has to do with our responsibility in relation to ourselves, being a living sacrifice. We have to present our bodies. We do it. God doesn't do it. We have to present our bodies as disciples of Christ as living sacrifices. The second challenge has to do with our relationship with God. It is a service of worship. It is an act of worship whereby we are honoring God, glorifying God. And our relationship with the world also is involved. Separation. Sacrifice, service, separation. Separation has to do with our contact with the world. So what he's saying basically is this. When we have been a recipient of the grace and the mercy of God in the gospel, when we have been given eternal life and abundant life now, when we've been given the Spirit, the very Spirit of Christ, and all that comes with that, we are to respond by offering our bodies a sacrifice, by recognizing that we're called now, we've died to ourselves, we are no longer our own, We live our lives as acts of worship in service. I'll never forget the comment, the quote from Mother Teresa when she was basically challenged to do more for the poverty-stricken people she was ministering to in India. And she said, "I want you to understand, my ministry is not social service. My ministry is not concentrated or focused on changing the physical, economic environment of the people that I am serving. I am serving not these people, I am serving Christ. And my ministry is a ministry of worship." In other words, her love in terms of giving dignity to the dying and to the forgotten was the way in which she saw the face of Christ in the people that she was ministering to. And she saw her ministry as basically a service of worship. Powerful insight that unfortunately a lot of us who are Protestants, you know, have a hard time getting. We could learn a lot from that. How does defilement or shipwreck conditions take place? I'm going to suggest that there's a path that sets us up for defilement. That is to have our testimony destroyed from the inside out. One is emptiness, an incomplete commitment to Christ. Desire to want to serve two masters. When Jesus said you cannot serve two masters, you will hate one and not the other. You'll wind up serving one and not the other. You can't serve both. Many of us, I would suggest maybe all of us, struggle deeply with this. This nagging sense of emptiness. We know that God is enough. We just don't experience Him as enough. We want something else. We want a long, healthy life. We want a robust, supportive, loving family. We want a job that's commensurate with our abilities, so forth and so on. We want our freedom. There are all kinds of things that we want. No problem wanting those things. We all want them. Nothing wrong with that. That's perfectly natural. But when our soul needs those things to have life, when they become the essence of life for us, where we basically come to the place where we say, "God, if you ask me to do anything that requires sacrificing those things, I'm not ready for that. Because I want you to save me with my idols, with my stuff. I'm going to bring my teddy bear along, you know, in terms of this thing. Or my family, or my home, or my job, or whatever it might be." And Jesus couldn't be more emphatic there. He's saying, if you want to have peace in life, you're going to have to separate yourself from those things which the world promises will bring peace, but can't. And the peace that I'm giving you, the world can't touch. And that means that, like Paul, you can be in prison. Like John the Baptist, you can be ready to lose your head. And somehow, although that's not pleasant, that's not the end. Your life is still significant. You are still loved. And there's a sense in which there's a security there that even though your life can be taken, as Jesus said, don't fear him who can take your body. Fear him who can basically take your soul. There's something more than bread. You can't live by bread alone. I mean, this theme is one we can't escape if you take the New Testament seriously. That emptiness sets us up for enticement or temptation. A failure to resist the temptation of the world's values. When I basically say, there's an emptiness in my life. I know Jesus should be enough. He's not enough. I feel bored. I feel fearful. I feel anxious. I'm looking for some kind of medication. Or as one of my professors said, many of us are like spiritual people with going around life with our spiritual umbilical cords in our hands, looking for someone to plug it into to give us life. And when we do that, the world is more than anxious to be there to offer us some hope. And if we can't resist that temptation,
going back to Romans 12, offer your body as a living sacrifice, be transformed in the renewing of your minds, that the way you see things, the way you think about things, if you can't resist the world at that point, you're going to be set up for defilement. The defilement will not be from what you touch, it'll be from how you see things, how you perceive where the source of life is all about. And then, of course, when that happens, once you buy into that, then it's a matter of just expressing it. When all of a sudden, your life is invested in human relationships as a source of life, and if your marriage doesn't work out, you get someone else. Or if your job is in jeopardy, you basically cut corners where you have to keep your job or to get your job. You do all kinds of things in behavior at that point to keep the idols that you've acquired intact and polished. And there's a certain sense in which you can say our behavior, our violation of the law, technically, comes almost always from a prior violation of a greater commandment of keeping or installing the Spirit of Christ deeply in our system, in our life, in such a way that we really experience His love and security to the place where we can resist. This is why, in a context of a church, I am very, very frustrated when I hear from the pulpit and in the context of Christian literature the command to simply resist sin. You know, bad things here, bad things there. Resist, resist, resist. No. There's a place for that, but don't start there. You start with fill. Fill yourself with Christ, then you can resist. If you're not filling yourself with Christ, resisting is going to be the work of a Pharisee and very, very frustrating for you. Matter of fact, I can guarantee you it will not be successful. The real challenge for us is to fill our lives with Christ, to abide in the vine, in a sense. I don't want to chase that rabbit too far. 1 John chapter 2, passage we've looked at before. Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eye, the boastful pride of life, is not from the Father, but from the world. And I've explained these things this way. This is not the only explanation possible. This is one that works for me. Makes sense to me. Lust of the flesh is basically my natural passions, basically centered on me, on my body, what I want. Lust of the eye, that's the way in which we see things. And we see things oftentimes from our culture in the context of a world that is only material. It's all stuff. There's not a spiritual dimension. It's just a material dimension. And the pride of life is a temporal focus. It's basically, I want it now. I want it in this life. I want a long life. I want a career. I don't want a career like John the Baptist or like Jesus. Short. You know? I want one basically that's long. And I don't want to spend time in prison like Paul. I want to be in the Colosseum in Rome, you know, or whatever it might be in your profession, so forth and so on. That is, we say, well, what's wrong with that? What's wrong with basically my passions and being practical, pragmatic, seeing things in terms of the material and thinking about a career? I'm going to suggest that when we read John through those lenses, we say that's what worldliness is. Worldliness is not basically doing certain things, touching certain things. It's basically having those attitudes. Now, that's what defiles us. Matthew chapter 6, going back to Jesus' teaching again, and this is a passage that gives us more insight into this whole thing. Do not lay up for yourself treasures upon earth, where moth and rust destroy, and where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, and where thieves do not break in or steal. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. And basically what he's saying is this. If it can be destroyed or can be stolen, don't become too attached to it. Now that's a very, very good motto. I've got to remind myself of that all the time. Several times every day, it seems to me. Because our world basically courts us with stuff that can be destroyed or be taken away from us. And it's very easy for us to become attached to these things. He also suggests laying up for yourself treasures in heaven, investing in the kingdom. Don't just rest in the kingdom. And where your treasure is, there your heart's going to be also. Your heart's passion follows the level of your investments. Many of us would like, if we were honest and asked the question, would you like to be closer to Christ? We'd say, of course I would. Would you like to be serving, or get rid of the dissonance in your life between serving two masters? Of course I would. I'd love that. Well, what are you doing about it? Well, you know, I just don't know what to do. I read scripture, and I go to church on Sunday, and I try to restrict my close fellowship to Christians, and so forth and so on. I mean, we're doing those kinds of things. I'm reading Christian literature. I've gone to a seminar or two, so forth and so on. Here's what Jesus would say. He'd say, basically, tell me, have you invested yourself in your faith in anything really significant in your life? Have you ever basically made a sacrifice in terms of the way you spend your time or your resources, in terms of ministry? And if I'm reading this correctly, what he's saying is this. When you start investing in something, your heart will follow that. And for many of us, we rest in the kingdom. We don't invest in the kingdom. We've got no horse in the race. We're basically in the pew, you know, waiting for someone to touch us and zap us and make us spiritual. And what Jesus is suggesting is that if you want those kind of changes to take place in your life, make an investment. Or to go back to the passage last week, start walking on water a little bit. You know, and basically take some risks. When Jesus fed the 5,000 to the disciples and gave them bread and says, you go feed them, they said, we can't do that. He said, just try it. And they started trying it, and the bread, the fish showed up as they were feeding them. What Jesus would be saying here, I think, along the same lines is this. You don't think that you can make an investment? Just try it. Try it. And see what happens in terms of your passion and interest. I think most of us have examples of where our passions have followed our investments. When I resigned as pastor of the Chapel Hill Bible Church, I took a position with a friend of mine, Keith Brown, in the ministry to home builders, Christian home builders. And what we were doing is networking Christian home builders around the country in terms of helping them in their Christian faith and in integrating their faith into their work. Now, I knew very little about ethics in business. I knew very little about home building. I knew more about spiritual development. But I found that one of the first things I did is I went online, I talked to friends, and I said, I want the five best books on Christian ethics in business that I could find. And I located those books by references. I got the books, started reading them. I learned about home building. I learned about the culture of executives in the home building business. And lo and behold, it took me no time at all. All of a sudden, I was interested. I was passionately involved in this. I had made an investment, and all of a sudden now, something I wasn't interested or passionate about before, I now was very engaged with. But I wouldn't have been had I not made an investment in that. Had I not put my life in that position. Had I not taken steps to cultivate that interest. I think you've had, I'm sure, experiences similar to that. The point that Jesus is making is this. If you don't make any investments, don't whine about not being passionate about your faith. If you'll be passionate about your faith, start making investments. He goes on. The lamp of the body is the eye. If therefore your eye is clear, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If therefore the light that is in you is darkness, how great is the darkness? When he says the lamp of the body is the eye, what he's saying here, I believe, is this. The way we see things shapes how we will act and what we will experience in life. How we will act in response and what we'll experience in our encounter with life. The way we see things, very, very important. So someone has said that mental illness, especially schizophrenia, is not a behavior. It's a perception. People who are schizophrenic see the world differently. They are acting rationally. Not according to our perceptions, but in their perceived world, their behaviors are rational. They may appear paranoid to us, but they see ants everywhere, crawling in their home and in their car, for example. They see them. They are afraid of all these creatures because they see them. Now, the challenge for us is spiritually, are we spiritually ill or healthy? Well, that depends on how we see things. If you see God as a out-of-touch old man who's very cranky and hard to please, you know, with a long staff with which he beats sheep, that's going to shape the way in which you live your Christian life. And there are many people who see God as just a very cruel taskmaster who never can be pleased. No matter how good you are, it's never good enough. You know, God is just sitting there and saying, whoa, whoa, whoa. You know, there are a lot of people that have that view of God. Listen, that'll determine how you act. It'll determine how you feel and what you experience. There are other people that see God in a very different way. They see Him as basically, oh, shucks, you know. I love everybody. Do what you want. I mean, you're free. God is like a Santa Claus. What do you want? I'm here to make your life happy. You know, Scripture says abundant Christian life. Basically, define it any way you want. You want stuff? You want it now? You want it all for yourself? Sure. That's why I exist. I exist for you. You're the man. You got to think. I mean, there are people that see God, you know, that way. And that's going to have an influence on how they behave and how they respond. This is why Jesus says, basically, the eye is critical. How you see things, very, very important. The image you have of yourself and of God and of the kingdom, powerful in terms of determining how you're going to, what you're going to experience and how you're going to behave. No one can serve two masters. For you'll either hate the one and love the other, or you will hold to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. For this reason I say to you, do not be anxious for your life, so as to what you shall eat, what you shall drink, nor for your body, as to what you shall put on. Is not life more than food, and the body more than clothing? Now, I think it's important here for us to recognize Jesus is not saying you don't need water, you don't need air, you don't need food. He's not saying that. You need all these things. But he's emphasizing the point. Life is more than that. And mixing your commitments with respect to your soul's food is defiling. My body needs those things. But you have a soul. You have an operating system in your body that is the real you. Your body's going to come and go. As a matter of fact, this body will go. I'll guarantee you that. It's not good for heaven. It has to go. It has to go if you want to go to heaven. If you want to be with God, this body has to go. Get used to that. Even though this world basically is going to encourage you to hang on to it at all costs. There's something inside of you that is the real you. And be careful, he's suggesting, how you feed that. You need more to experience life. You need more than just the things that make your body comfortable. You need things that basically are going to make your soul come alive and enable you to endure hardships with respect to the body. If the world can give it or take it away, it's something we need to keep a loose hold on. Don't attach yourself too carefully to it. That is to your soul. I'm going to be misunderstood here, potentially. I don't want to be. I need to qualify myself. There's nothing wrong with stuff. Nothing wrong with living in the now. There's nothing wrong with being responsible for me. Those things are not defiling. It's when those things come to be the center of my understanding of what it means to be an image bearer of God. That's when there's a problem. I become defiled not because I touch things or have things or in certain places. It's basically, what do I bring to those situations? What is the state of my soul when, in the case of 1 Corinthians 10, when I am invited to a pagan's home, by the way, for a Jewish person, that was anathema. The fact that a person could be godly and be a godly Jew and eat with a Gentile, that was polluting for sure. And Paul assumes you're going to have those invitations, and he encourages people to respond to them positively. Even when you go to a pagan's home, one who is defiled, one who is unclean, and they serve you demonic food, eat it, unless they make an issue of it. And that's because, not because it'll defile you, it's because it may send a wrong message to them. It may confuse them. Those things, basically, you say, you're free to do those things. You should live a life that is free from fear. Because Christ's Spirit has delivered you from that. But guard your soul. Be very careful what you're feeding your soul. Be very careful what your soul is being attached to. Be very careful where you're finding your security and significance and the source of your peace. Be very careful what has a messianic role in your life. That is, those things that determine how you make your biggest decisions, where you find your peace and security, where your faith, hope, and love is attached. Be very careful about those attachments. That seems to be what he's saying. Here's basically the punchline, I believe. Worldliness and defilement come not from being in the world. We shouldn't be afraid of that. But from a heart that has lost contact with Christ. And when we've lost contact with Christ in our heart, when Christ's Spirit is not installed deeply in our heart, then we're vulnerable no matter what we do. You can live your life. You can bring a cot and camp out in the church. And basically, you can go to every church service that exists. You can be involved in Christian ministry. You can go to the mission field and sanitize yourself in such a way that you never have contact with worldly people. But you're going to be defiled if Christ is not installed in your heart. And installing Christ in your heart is not just a matter of doing things. It has to do with the way you see things and with the faith commitment you make. And the degree to which you make that, and the investments you make in life that basically draw your heart to those things. Lessons for us today. First of all, the mark of true spirituality is not zeal or sincerity, but the sharing of God's heart. There are several ways you can define spirituality. Now I define it this way. It's basically sharing the heart of Christ. That needs to be unpacked in a lot of ways, but that's the essence of it. Guard your heart, for from it come the issues of life. That's a proverb. Both worldliness and godliness come from a heart. Idolatrous behavior always comes from an inner, misplaced faith, hope, and love. We misbehave when our heart basically is disattached. Don't fear defilement from outer contact, but know where your heart is vulnerable and guard it with passion. Now, just one caution here. There are times when guarding my heart means there are certain environments I shouldn't be in, certain things I shouldn't touch, certain people I shouldn't be around, so forth and so on. That is very understandable, and it's something that is very important. But it's not the contact that defiles me. It's the danger that contact might bring in terms of the health of what it feeds my soul. So when someone says, you know, I wouldn't have that in my home. I wouldn't have a TV in my home, someone would say. I'd say, I understand. That's fine. Or I wouldn't have a credit card. You know, Christians can't have credit cards. For you, maybe you can't have a credit card. But other people, that's not a problem. TV, is not a problem for some people. Being a Democrat is not a problem for some people. Really? Hard for some people to believe that. But or Republican, too, depending on what side of the aisle you're on. The point is, those things in themselves don't do it. It's basically what's happening in terms of what you're processing, what's coming into you, to your heart. What are you taking in? What are you investing in? So forth and so on. That's where the issue is. So next week, we'll talk about the Syrophoenician woman, and we're going to see here a very interesting contrast. Mark doesn't explain this as a contrast, but he sets it up to be a contrast, I believe. We're going to see the Pharisees, who are all concerned about defilement with the world. And now we're going to see Jesus taking a person who is deeply defiling and basically pouring his heart out to her when he stiff-arms the Pharisees. I mean, the contrast here is dramatic in terms of the Syrophoenician woman with her problems and how Jesus responds to her. But read ahead in Mark chapter 7 for that. Okay, we've got some time to talk. Yes, Rosemary.
Jim, don't you think a big component during this lesson is that, I guess I've been taught this growing up Southern Baptist, that you might be a stumbling block in some of these issues. You don't do them because you're a stumbling block to non-believers.
That's exactly the point Paul's making. It doesn't defile us.
Right.
But it can defile someone else. And he says, basically, you are members of one another. Therefore, if restricting yourself and saying no to something that you personally feel free to do would hurt someone else, then he's saying, say no to it. Yes, Cody.
I'm so excited about the way that has been presented, because to me this is the essence of our civilization, visiting Christianity, the development of the unfolding of the individual in a spiritual way, not in a spiritual way.
Yeah.
And how that contrasts with the group understanding. And I think this is one of the major problems in our understanding in our civilization today, because we have this idea that we can do good only through the group.
Yes.
But everything you've said and everything that's presented there from the Christian point of view and from Christ, it is the individual heart that counts so much.
Well, so put it this way. Christianity that doesn't start with the individual doesn't start. And Christianity that stops with the individual stops. There's a sense in which you can't deny the fact that when Paul and the other apostles and Jesus are ministering, they're ministering to the hearts of individuals. They're touching individuals. But you must be also careful to recognize that these individuals are a part of a body, and we are part of a community of humans who share the image of God. And in that respect, we're not islands. I mean, we're a community as well. And in keeping that and navigating the relationship between our individual responsibility and our community responsibility, very, very critical. And I think it's outside of Christianity, and even sometimes inside Christianity, that's been distorted, and we've lost our way on that in many, many respects. By the way, that's an interesting subject for discussion with respect to being in but not of the world. To what extent are we to see ourselves as individuals or as a part of a community? That's a good question. And I hope we'll have a chance to address that, you know, in the series. Any other comments, that questions or answers?
Jim?
Yes?
Aren't there certain, in any given time in our culture, certain behaviors, certain things that offer particular temptation? I think in our day, for example, pornography is an illustration of this. That quite clearly has powerful potential impact, and that therefore might come close to being a exposure that you would would really recommend that all Christians avoid.
There are a lot of things that certainly, I would not say that you're free to sample cocaine, or crack. That's not for pornography. This is something that you're free to do this. No problem. I mean, that's obvious. There are certain things that, but I think when you ask the question about addictive substances, which is what we're talking about, you have to ask the question, I think if you're wise, why are these things so attractive to our heart? What purpose do they serve? What do they give us? We are attracted to addictive substances because they fill an emptiness in our life that's not being filled someplace else. And I think that's where we've got to address the problem. I mean, when I say, basically, how do you help someone get off drugs when they're hooked on drugs? Because drugs give people a huge high, a sense of being alive. Well, you can't do it by just saying, get over it, snap out of it, and or, as Christians, in the name of Jesus, snap out of it. That's not going to work. You have to fill the life with something. There has to be something in there that gives life, that frees you, so you no longer have the inability to resist those temptations. You know, this is part of what I hear Jesus saying. The fact that the way we see our resources, if we see basically, I got 5,000 hungry people here, and I've just got a few fish and a few loaves. That's not going to do it. I need to get help someplace else. I don't care what Jesus says, and he's not very practical. I'm going to town. Going to Sam's, coming back to stuff, feed these people. When we take that option, we're saying something about how we see things, how we see our options. But if we see ourselves as having resources that really are sufficient to give us life and to live a life that God is calling us to, and are willing to take a step with that, step in faith into the dark. Whereas one of my mentors told me, he said, faith is simply trusting God in the dark. It's trusting God before you see what's there. And I think that's a lot of it. But you're right. I think if someone is breaking the commandments, and abusing other people, abusing themselves, there's no way in which we're free to do that. But I think the problem is not what's being done there, it's what's behind it, if we're going to change that behavior.
And when we talk about filling ourselves, with either God or filling ourselves with worldly things,
yes.
It's interesting to kind of think through what that filling involves. In the case of the world, it can be these habitual things. It can also be things that are more subtle, like materialism, right?
Sure.
A shop till I drop, right? Things with the things of this world.
Yeah.
They aren't necessarily sometimes we don't think of them as bad, but they can be so filling that they displace this other than God, right?
Right.
In the case of God as filling us, what is that about? Is it about we fill ourselves with a hope in Him, mm-hmm. a trust in Him, is that adequate? Can that fill us enough that we don't need this other stuff?
Joe, what you're saying is I think really on target. It's possible to fill your stuff with something other than cocaine and pornography that basically is a good displacement, but not an adequate displacement. You can go into the ministry, you can be obsessed as a minister. There are a lot of pastors who are obsessed. They're basically addicted to success and ministry and so forth and so on. And I would suggest that spiritually, in the eyes of God, He's saying, I don't care if it's pornography or cocaine or ministry. If you're addicted to it, and it's giving you life, you got a problem. Now, again, you may be socially accepted if you're basically committed to materialism, making as much money as you can and consuming as much as you can, but you're still addicted that way. Now, I think that is part of the problem. the other thing is, how do you fill yourself with God? What does that mean? Well, first of all, I think you need to say that in this life, we're going to be frustrated. This is why we long for heaven, because we don't experience heaven here. But we can experience enough of it to be in the situation where Paul was, where he was forgotten in prison and still had a sense of joy, peace, and energy to love. That's something that I think is within our grasp, but not without still having a longing for something that we don't and can't get in this life. We will always have that longing, always have that frustration. But if we're at a place where basically we can't rejoice in the hardships of this life, we are fearful of God taking away the props we have, at that point, we can escape that. There's help for us in that situation. You don't have to be there. And I think that is realistic for us to basically pray and become a part of a community that is going to encourage us to say, you don't have to have these things to experience real peace, real joy, to really feel secure, and to feel as though you're significant in the world, that you make a difference, that you mean something, and that you're loved. You don't need those things for that to take place. And if we feel we do, that's something that can be changed. But for all of us, we're going to be in process of that. I don't think there's a place in this life, I know there's not a place in this life where you can say, I'm over the hill now, I'm breaking through the faith barrier, and I've experienced heaven. Heaven is going to be no change. I'm just going to, it's kind of a transition, you know, from the way I'm living my life right now. Heaven on earth. That's not, when I hear people talk that way, I don't hear many people, most of my friends have given up on talking that way, but when I hear people talk that way, and I say, what kind of world do you live in? That's not the world Paul lived in. Paul groaned for nature, but he could write a letter of joy and hope and peace in prison. And both of those are a part of Paul's experience. He could say, wretched man that I am, who can deserve this body of death? His struggle with the passions of his flesh and of the world's temptations around him. But at the same time, he could say, I'm an overcomer in Jesus Christ. I see myself in the Spirit of Christ. I see myself as free from those things. Those things no longer condemn me. So forth and so on. So there's a lot of that dynamic that is a part of the reality of following Christ.
He didn't have that emptiness because he was filled with the Spirit.
That's right.
The Holy Spirit.
If Christ's Spirit is installed in us, and that I like that way of expressing it. When He is installed in our system, He's not a virus. He basically is the operating system. When that happens, the whole operation changes. The way we see things change. The way we respond to things change. What we see as food, what energizes us changes, so forth and so on. And the kind of community we want to be a part of changes. Tommy.
Yeah, I was going to say, Jim, very interesting discussion that really hits me right between the eyes, because after many, many years of addiction, we were struggling with that. Ended up, it was a supernatural process. It was a state of brokenness that had to come God's way. And it was years of pain and suffering, emotionally, spiritually, whatever. But it got to the point that I awoke on a prison bunk with more joy and contentment than I ever had. There's nothing I did. It was completely a state of brokenness that went through a process. It wasn't something I just said, today I'm going to be full of joy.
Yeah.
It was a supernatural process through a state of brokenness that had to happen like that. And looking back, the first time I ever took a pain medicine was for a sinus infection. And I remember exactly, about 25 years ago, saying, where has this been all my life? It doesn't have to be with drugs. It can be with everything else.
Yes.
But it filled a void that was just. I knew then, looking back, I was going to take something miraculous to get that changed over to something else.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that, Tommy. That's a Okay, our time is gone. We'll continue next week.